From Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship, this is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, October 21, 2003. At WBAI in New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. Human Rights Watch releases a scathing report saying that excessive and indiscriminate force is being used by the US military in Iraq to cause too many civilian deaths, which the military is then not properly investigating. Canada is now deporting Muslims and Pakistanis out of the country to the United States. And President Bush continues his Southeast Asian tour, pushing for more regional support in his war on terrorism. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Today, the Bush administration was proud of new numbers showing the federal deficit is lower than what was predicted. Yet the $374.2 billion figure is the largest deficit in the history of the United States. Bush administration officials say the deficit is mostly due to the so-called war on terrorism. An official with the White House Office of Budget and Management says next year the deficit will be even larger at around $500 billion. Consumers who join together in class action lawsuits may face a greater challenge as Congress looks to give big business more leverage. Craig Murphy reports from D.C.
Congress is ready to give big business an even bigger advantage against consumers who join together in class action lawsuits. If the so-called Class Action Fairness Act of 2003 passes, civil action cases would be moved to federal courts, which Frank Clemente, the director of Public Citizens Congress Watch, believes puts citizens and consumers at a number of disadvantages. One disadvantage is that since the cases are still state-based, federal judges must make judgments using state laws.
A federal judge is much less willing to interpret state law in new and novel ways. So when you have cases like against HMOs or the tobacco industry, they're much less likely to go forward in federal court.
After years of corporate lobbying, the House passed their version of the act earlier this year, and the Senate is set to vote on the act tomorrow. Supporters of the bill are still three votes short of the required number needed to pass the measure and may be unable to end the filibuster that Democrats have said they will use to prevent the vote. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Craig Murphy.
Protesters are actually being heard at the eighth round of negotiations for the Central American Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA. From Houston, Renee Feltz reports.
This week, over 300 trade negotiators from Guatemala, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Honduras, and El Salvador will discuss the Central American Free Trade Agreement behind closed doors in Houston's Ritzy Galleria area. CAFTA could become the first regional trade accord signed by the United States since NAFTA, an agreement that many charge has increased poverty levels in Mexico's rural areas, where small farmers must now compete with subsidized agricultural products from the north. On Monday, supporters of fair trade measures protested just outside the doors of conference rooms where negotiators were meeting. A bilingual banner reading No CAFTA was hung from the balcony of a room in the hotel hosting the talks. Similar banners were on view from several freeway overpasses. More protests, along with a Central American community forum on CAFTA, are scheduled here throughout the week. From KPFT in Houston, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
The Bush administration has agreed to halt its export of toxic Navy ships pending further environmental review. Meanwhile, four other vessels are on their way to England. More from Kelly Ramirez.
The four ships are among 13 vessels carrying about 700 tons of PCBs, 1,400 tons of asbestos, and 3,300 tons of old fuel oil. Five domestic ship scrapping firms bid on the work, hoping to bring jobs to the U.S., but the government has other preferences, according to Martin Wagner, an attorney for Earth Justice, which is suing to stop the toxic exports.
There is a fleet of over 150 decaying naval vessels, all full of toxic materials, and the plan is to send most of them to developing countries like India and Bangladesh, which is of a special concern because the environmental and worker protection standards there are very weak. In this case, originally the hope of the government was to send them to Asia, but because of the SARS outbreak, they were concerned about sending people there to check on the facilities, so they ended up settling on England.
Wagner says it's possible that the British government will reject the ships, meaning they will have to be towed back across the North Atlantic during the winter storm season. For FSRN, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
A growing number of workers in big companies are without insurance. The report released by the Commonwealth Fund says that 32% of all uninsured workers in 2001 worked for companies with more than 500 employees. One of the study's authors says that as the U.S. government is offering incentives for small and mid-sized companies to encourage employer-supported health benefits, large numbers of workers may actually be left behind. Besides rising health care costs, the study also blames fewer union jobs and changing corporate structures that rely more heavily on temporary and part-time workers. I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Human Rights Watch released a report today suggesting there have been some 94 credible reports of civilian deaths in Baghdad since President Bush declared an end to major combat in May. Human Rights Watch says excessive and indiscriminate force by the U.S. military has caused 20 confirmed deaths. The Human Rights Organization charges the U.S. military with not conducting proper investigation into these incidents. And as Mitch Jeserich reports from Capitol Hill, it's unlikely the report will spur congressional investigations either.
The U.S. military does not keep track of the number of civilian deaths in Iraq that it may have caused, so the organization Human Rights Watch interviewed Iraqi police officers, civilians, family members of victims, and scoured through Iraqi documents and media reports, and has come up with a number of its own. In a new report, Human Rights Watch estimates that in the past 5 months, aggressive raids and checkpoints by the military has caused as many as 94 civilian deaths in Baghdad alone, 20 of which the group says are confirmed. Joe Stork with Human Rights Watch says the military's investigation into these deaths has been inadequate.
They did carry out, they told us they completed 5 investigations. In 4 of those 5, they found that the soldiers acted within the rules of engagement, in other words, acted properly. We investigated 2 of those 4 cases, and our evidence pointed in the other direction.
The report says U.S. forces faced a real threat in some of those cases, giving them the right to respond. But it also says the response was sometimes disproportionate and indiscriminate, killing innocent civilians. Stork says the problem is that U.S. soldiers are not trained on how to occupy a country.
You know, there are reasons why this is happening. I mean, American soldiers didn't speak Arabic, did not have any translator with them. So would be shouting commands in English. There are basic training elements here that weren't carried out. We found that basically these were combat troops, in many instances, combat troops who had fought their way into Iraq and then were suddenly had a new mission.
Human Rights Watch recommends that signs at the checkpoints be in Arabic and that interpreters accompany all raids. It is calling for increased investigation by the military into these cases. The Department of Defense has yet to respond, and it's doubtful that the report will stir Congress to act. Republican Senator Craig Thomas of Wyoming, who just returned from Iraq a couple of weeks ago, doesn't think any additional investigations are needed.
All we heard really from the Iraqis and the officials, and local and national, was how much they wanted the troops to stay there and that they were a vital part of the recuperation and the restructuring. I didn't hear anything about that at all.
We have good people over there, and they're just frightened to death. And we're not taking the steps we should to internationalize this conflict.
Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer represents California. She says though the cases should be looked at, the real problem comes from the White House.
We have to realize the type of a burden we are placing on our men and women. I went over to Walter Reed Hospital, and I met with some of them. They said it's just disastrous. They don't have the right equipment because this administration didn't plan for this type of a post-war situation.
International Answer is planning a mass rally this Saturday, calling for the troops in Iraq to come home and for the international community to take over the occupied country. Dr. Stephen Cleghorn, with Military Families Speak Out, has a stepson serving in Iraq. He tells what his stepson's wife has learned through letters.
He tells her that morale is low in Iraq, that it's, quote, hard to see what good is happening here, and that they as a couple, she tells me, grieve because the United States had so many other choices that our country could have made and did not.
Demonstrators will be gathering at the Washington Monument in D.C. on Saturday. There will also be a coinciding demonstration in San Francisco to bring the troops home. Both demonstrations begin at 11 a.m. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Cesarich in Washington.
Yesterday, the U.S. budget deficit figures were released, showing a record high deficit, which many attribute to the massive increases in spending to fund the so-called war on terrorism, which critics note will be the burden worn by generations to come. This is on his Southeast Asian tour. President Bush has been meeting with world leaders of the region at the 11th APEC, or Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit, which closed in the Thai capital, Bangkok. The 21 members reaffirmed commitments to free trade, while the larger countries, such as the US and Australia, called for greater commitment to fight global terrorism. From Bangkok, Dwali Saikatau has more.
Thailand's Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat declared today that APEC leaders reaffirmed their commitment to the multilateral trading system, and he stressed that in order to reduce poverty and enhance competition, capacity building was key among APEC economies.
APEC must continue with human and institutional capacity building and make sure that such efforts yield results. APEC should also promote more investment among members.
The APEC group also agreed to control weapons like MANPADS, or man-portable defense systems.
If it were to be used, it will interrupt the aviation industries. The people will be afraid of traveling. It will hurt the aviation industry.
The ban of MANPADS was proposed by Washington during the APEC summit and was part of the agenda pushed by U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell and President Bush, who attended the APEC forum before flying to Singapore on the rest of his Asia tour.
Bush is the symbolic of capitalism. And now this capitalism come to be like imperialism.
That's Vipa Domini, an activist in Bangkok. She says Mr. Bush held private talks with the Thai Prime Minister, APEC investors, and other rich people, but didn't bother to talk to average working people.
Many people now is homeless and still poor.
Some APEC delegates said North Korea and terrorism should not have dominated the discussions. U.S. officials had reportedly tried to push for APEC leaders to include a statement about North Korea and its nuclear ambitions, but no such inclusion was made. The next meeting of APEC members will be November of next year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Dwahli Saikautau in Bangkok.
Despite the Bolivian people's victory in ousting their president, it remains unclear whether Bolivia's new government under President Carlos Mesa will be able to maintain power. Some challenges that the new government is facing include redrafting the constitution to include and respect Bolivia's indigenous peoples, who make up 70% of the population, confronting government corruption, and the recent massacres of protesters committed by the army. However, as Nicole Carson reports from La Paz, perhaps the greatest obstacle now is how the government will deal with free trade and neoliberal projects, which the majority of the Bolivian people demonstrated they firmly oppose.
The issue of exporting natural gas takes the lead because it was the spark that ignited Bolivia's social uprising. Osvaldo Calle, a Bolivian journalist from Bol Press, offers his analysis.
Es que tenemos un gobierno prisionero del pueblo. Porque es un gobierno que no va a poder dar pasos.
We have a government that is imprisoned by the people. For example, on the issue of gas, they can't do anything else but give the people a referendum. But as the government is simultaneously a prisoner of the popular movement, it is also a hostage of the political system. Because in the moment he announced he would govern without political parties, he's had difficulty forming a cabinet. It's taken him 2 days to form a cabinet, and this is the first demonstration of how weak this government will be.
Felipe Quispe, an indigenous leader of the Pachakutik indigenous movement who initiated the uprising in September, has not stopped roadblocks and hunger strikes like other opposition groups. His demands include the issue of natural gas reserves, but also encompasses rights to land, universities, hospitals, and roads for Bolivia's indigenous peoples. Felipe Quispe says that Carlos Mesa's government will not last 3 months.
Carlos Mesa will not be able to fulfill our demands. In 3 months, he'll have grave problems, and we'll be counting our deaths and blocking highways again.
In the referendum President Carlos Mesa has proposed, the Bolivian people will decide whether their natural gas is sold to transnationals, and in particular, the United States. Quispe explains what the referendum should ask the Bolivian people.
We have to ask whether to industrialize or not, whether to sell gas. The Bolivians who have fought, struggled, and given their lives would say that we won't sell it if we don't industrialize the gas here. We can sell it, we want to sell it, but after it's processed here. That's what we want to do, and that's the thinking of the Bolivian people.
Eva Morales is an indigenous coca grower leader of the movement toward socialism, and he almost beat Sanchez de Lozada in the last election. Morales has the popular support of Bolivians, who hope he will win the presidency in the next elections. He says his people are not satisfied with the government of Carlos Mesa because Mesa does not respond to the social movements. But he is satisfied that Sanchez de Lozada was toppled because he represented neoliberalism and corruption. Evo Morales does not discard the possibility that once the social movements take power in Bolivia, the United States will interfere.
When the democracies don't serve the politics of the empire makes a coup d'etat. Now that indigenous peoples are growing as a political power, it's possible that the empire wants to end democracy for a dictatorship controlled by the United States.
The general feeling in Bolivia is that it remains to be seen how the new government will grapple with the challenges that face South America's poorest nation. But one thing is sure. Bolivians want ex-president Sanchez de Lozada, who they say is responsible for more than 80 violent deaths of protesters, brought to justice. La Paz's daily, La Razón, reported that ex-president Sanchez, who is now in Miami, will travel to Washington, where the U.S. government has commended his commitment to democracy. On October 13th, the second day of Bolivia's mass killings committed by the army, the U.S. State Department issued a call for respect for constitutional order in Bolivia, stating, "The American people and their government support Bolivia's democratically elected President Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada in his efforts to build a more prosperous future for all Bolivians." In La Paz, Bolivia, I'm Nicole Carson for Free Speech Radio News.
Currently in Montreal, there are hundreds of Pakistani refugees facing deportation to the United States and Pakistan in the coming days, weeks, and months. These Pakistani refugees, who are mainly Shia Muslim, fleeing religious persecution in Pakistan, are self-organizing to fight against the efforts of Citizenship and Immigration Canada to deport them. Today, one Pakistani family and three children is scheduled for deportation to the United States. Their case has become a defining point for the fight to stop Pakistani deportations in Montreal. Stefan Christoph has this report.
The Ubad family of five, facing deportation to the United States today, have been in Canada for over 15 months, during which time Canadian immigration officials rejected their asylum claim. The Abad family fled Pakistan in September 2002 to the U.S. after being persecuted by Sunni Islamic groups such as the SSP, with documented human rights abuses against Shiite Muslims by Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. After seeking asylum in the United States in 2001, the Abad family then fled to Canada, saying they felt their lives threatened during the generalized backlash against Arab, Muslim, and South Asian communities in the U.S. The family is now facing deportation to the New York State border, their point of entry into Canada, where they will be faced with U.S. Customs officials and almost certainly face immediate detention. FSRN spoke with Navidi Bad, the father of the family.
It is not easy to leave the country and to leave all the properties and businesses and relatives and to cross the oceans and then come into the Canada, and they're the last hope of every refugees. So we hope and we pray they may have it, they change their mind and to provide the protection for the refugees.
The Abad family story is echoed by hundreds of other Pakistani refugees who fled the United States in fear of religious persecution, detention, and the mandatory INS registration for many Arabs, Muslims, and South Asians, as it was introduced by the U.S. Justice Department and Homeland Security Office after the September 11th attacks. Shaim Naim of the Action Committee of Pakistani Refugees in Montreal, who is also facing deportation to the United States in early November, spoke about her fear of being forcibly deported to the U.S.
She's saying that if they go back to the U.S., they will be put into detention right away, and then they'll face torture in the U.S. in the detentions. All of the males over 16 will be profiled, fingerprinted, all of that's going on in the U.S. night, all the roundups, especially of Muslim and South Asian men. And then from there, they will be deported back to Pakistan anyway. So being deported to the U.S. ultimately does still mean being deported to Pakistan. So all it does is prolongs their anxiety, prolongs their suffering.
The campaign to stop the deportation of Pakistani refugees is taking place within the context of a growing movement of immigrant and refugee communities organizing against tough new immigration laws and policies in Canada post 9/11, often drawn from new immigration policies implemented in the United States. The No One Is Illegal campaign of Montreal has monitored and fought deportation orders for the past 2 years. No One Is Illegal argues that the crisis facing Canada's refugees reflects a larger picture of forced displacement experienced throughout the Global South, often prompted by foreign policy of G8 nation states. Harsha Walia of the No One Is Illegal campaign.
Situations in communities in the South are created very much from our histories of colonization that we faced, our histories of, you know, what's now called religious extremism in South Asia and the Arab world have very much been created by forces here. If we look at it from that perspective, when we talk about globalization and the forces that create the conditions for migration, and especially settler states in North America, Australia, and New Zealand, to acknowledge that those forces are created by those of us who live here, by those governments and those corporations that are in fact here. These governments are very keen on making, you know, creating stable situations, for example, in Pakistan, opening the borders to trade. That means that refugees are increasingly displaced and they need to be deported back because you have to prove that these countries are safe for return.
The Abad family, who are slated for deportation early Tuesday morning to the U.S., are currently detained by Canadian immigration officials in Montreal. The Abad family are expecting to be deported to the U.S. side of the Lacal border crossing in New York State, where they likely face detention and fear the possible deportation to Pakistan. I'm Stefan Christoff, reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Montreal.
People don't realize that the conferees just tossed out our support of Roe v. Wade without even a discussion.
That's Senate Democrat from California, Barbara Boxer, talking about the first new federal restrictions on abortion in 30 years, legislation to ban late-term abortions, which, as we go to air, the Senate is set to vote on. It's expected to pass the Senate. Barbara Boxer again.
What this really is about is overturning Roe, because there is no health exception. What other reason would they have? We would have had a bill if they had a health exception. So we just want to make the point that women matter here, and we're just trying to show that we think the real agenda here is for them to overturn Roe.
The Senate vote comes as, weeks ago, the House passed this legislation. This is last month the State Department cut off funding for a British non-governmental organization doing family planning work in China, among other places. In response, half a dozen international public health groups took the unprecedented step of refusing their own U.S. funding. The group says it's an ideological battle over abortion, which has repercussions for the health of poor people around the world. From New York, Josh Chaffin has this report on some of the lessons public health groups have learned from taking a stand.
In an uptown Manhattan classroom at Columbia University, grad students are listening to public health professionals talk about what they see as a creeping threat to reproductive health efforts around the world. That is the ever more vigorous application of U.S. restrictions on anything even remotely related to abortion.
I can no longer even talk to, sit in a meeting with, a group who talks to somebody else about abortion counseling.
International reproductive health advocates say they've been losing ground steadily since the Reagan administration's 1984 declaration at a UN population conference in Mexico City. That policy, which is also known as the Global Gag Rule, banned U.S. support for family planning agencies involved in any way with the provision of abortion. Under George W. Bush, enforcement of that policy has been stepped up. Family planning groups working in China have been singled out for special attention since Chinese agencies have been known to use forced abortion and forced sterilization in order to meet the central government's strict population reduction targets. Speaking from London, Samantha Guy insists things are now getting better in China.
They are moving very strongly away from such rigid targets and are in fact working with groups to stop abortions.
Samantha Guy has good reason to tout any positive changes in China. She works with the reproductive health group Marie Stopes International, which lost its U.S. State Department funding last month for being connected to the controversial reproductive health campaigns in China. The administration said it was a legal decision, but Guy doesn't believe it, contending that Marie Stopes has nothing to do with forced abortion.
The State Department itself said they had no evidence.
So you think the administration just wanted to make an example of someone?
Yeah, exactly.
In addition to their work in China, Marie Stopes International works with a consortium of groups that provide reproductive health services to people in conflict zones, relying in part on U.S. funding. When Marie Stopes lost its State Department support, the other members of the Reproductive Health for Refugees Consortium took the unprecedented step of declining any U.S. money, insisting the allegations against their colleagues were baseless. Julia Matthews works with the Women's Commission for Refugee Women and Children, one of the groups in the consortium.
We thought that was essential to make sure that people knew that we were not agreeing with the accusations made against them.
Punishing Marie Stopes for the involvement in the Chinese one-child policy, yeah, I'm happy about that. I think that's a good thing.
In a high-rise building across the street from the United Nations, the vice president of CFAM, the Catholic Family and Human Rights Institute, Douglas Silva lobbies UN delegations against abortion and the distribution of condoms. He complains that media stories about the Marie Stopes controversy have blamed the administration for the closings of public health clinics in Kenya and elsewhere, ignoring the fact that nobody forced the consortium to reject their U.S. funding.
The consortium had every opportunity to simply take the money and use it without involving Marie Stopes International.
Silva's group is part of a movement of what he calls family values advocates that has gained considerable clout since Reagan's Mexico City policy was announced in 1984. Columbia University public health professor Lynn Friedman sees these groups adopting human rights language to push an agenda that she calls anti-feminist.
They were at the UN special session on HIV/AIDS, on children, because they're sort of seeing broader places for their agenda.
The Catholic Church admitted last week it has begun spreading the message in the developing world that microscopic holes in condoms make them ineffective. Meanwhile, the groups who declined their U.S. funding in solidarity with Marie Stopes International say they may have to kill a new program in Angola that was supposed to provide HIV services to young people. Josh Chaffin in New York City for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York and KPFA in Berkeley and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Kata Mesta and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. Our DC editor is Mitch Jeserich. The technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Million and Lindsay Benedict. FSRN is a worker-run collective. And for more information, visit our website at www.fsrn.org. In New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez.